This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Hi there, I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear from the Kalamazoo City Manager about the ongoing protests over homelessness.
We do not have the capacity or are we equipped to provide services directly to homeless and really do that work.
There's a new movie about Detroit's white boy Rick. A consultant on the film says his portrayal was distorted by law enforcement.
The idea that as a 14 or a 15-year-old or 16-year-old that he was somehow lording over the Detroit drug scene just was a falsehood.
You are not the only one who buys school supplies for your kids. More than likely, their teacher does too.
We are initially usually supplied pencils and crayons and glue, and parents contribute to that, but halfway through the year, that runs out.
Plus, we talk to the gubernatorial candidates Bill Schuette and Gretchen Whitmer as they talk about health care coverage. But first, an update of the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. So later in the program, we will talk about Medicaid and health, the Healthy Michigan Plan, with Democratic candidate for governor Gretchen Whitmer and Republican candidate for governor Bill Schuette. But first, earlier this week, we heard from protesters in Kalamazoo who are camped out at a city park. They want the city to do more to help homeless people. Kalamazoo City Commissioner Shannon Sykes-Nearing outlined the five demands of the protesters, which include the commission discussing homelessness, that police investigate alleged abuses at the city's only shelter, that homeless people have access to physical and mental health care, that the city find a structurally sound building that the protesters can fix up before the snow flies, and that the city adopt a housing first strategy. The commission has directed Kalamazoo City Manager Jim Ritzema to address these demands. I spoke with him earlier today and asked him, how's that going?
Well, we actually have been meeting with the representatives from the encampment really for the last 2 weeks now. And, it's been slow in progress. We have offered other locations as options to relocate, and they've been rejected. So what I've done in response to these issues, we've convened a work group made up of experts around the table to focus both on the short-term and long-term solutions. And that work has just begun, and these new demands we received earlier this week, and we are going to launch into addressing them for all homeless individuals, not just those that are represented in the encampment.
The protesters we heard from earlier this week say they feel the city, and in particular you, have not really listened to their concerns. Are you hearing them?
Absolutely. I think, this is a very difficult, complex problem. And we the city were brought into this through an ordinance change where the city commission wanted to decriminalize several of the park rules. And I think that got misinterpreted into we're criminalizing homelessness. And that's how we really were pulled into this. And I have been listening to them. A lot of times they don't focus, on solutions. And so it gets somewhat difficult. But we're certainly at the table. They really have shined a light on this, and I think we're listening, and again, we're working towards solutions for this real complex, difficult problem.
Well, you want to stop them from camping in the park. They want a place to go since the Gospel Mission Shelter won't take some of them, and others are making allegations of abuse. What does that solution look like?
Well, that's a good question. We have around the table those organizations that are working in this realm every day. The state, MISHDA, has been involved in the conversation now, as this is a state issue and a federal national issue.
Right. Commissioner Shannon Sykes-Nearing is insisting that the city of Kalamazoo find a solution. Number one, what's the city's responsibilities to the homeless people? And what would you like the state and federal and county officials to do?
So our responsibility is to provide services to all individuals, residents of the city of Kalamazoo. We are not in the service provision realm. We do not have the capacity or are we equipped to provide services directly to homeless and really do that work. What we are able to do is convene those organizations that do the work and start working and focusing on solutions.
And the federal and state officials, what do you want them to do?
Well, you know, there's a lot of work to be done at those levels in terms of policy and, you know, providing adequate funding for housing and you know, support services. You know, the issue of homelessness, as I mentioned, is very complex. It has to do with mental illness, addiction, and, you know, folks that truly are in crisis and need help. And just providing them a home is not going to solve this. You know, all the support services that they need to stay in that home and to lift themselves up need to be funded and funded well so we can really make an impact.
One of the demands was about the alleged abuses at the shelter. Is the police department investigating these allegations at the Gospel Mission Shelter?
So when this came up at the city commission meeting Monday night, the actual motion or that demand was changed to the city commission affirms that the Kalamazoo Department of Public Safety will investigate alleged criminal acts against homelessness. And that's the work that public safety will be doing and has been doing. It's complaint based. So someone files a complaint, a criminal complaint, the public safety department is going to investigate that. And if it involves the Gospel Mission, that'll be part of the investigation.
Is that the only homeless shelter in Kalamazoo?
Yeah, the only overnight shelter.
Are the people protesting homelessness in Kalamazoo still going to be in tents in Bronson Park when winter hits?
Well, our intent would be for that not to happen. I've been very clear in my conversations with the encampment that they're there illegally, and at some point we're going to need to do something to clear that park. It's not healthy, it's not safe, and we need to protect everyone that wants to come and enjoy the park, including the encampment. And really what we need to do is separate out the protest movement from those that are truly in need and homeless, the involuntary homeless, and provide them immediate access to those services that they need to become sheltered.
I want to understand, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you talking about arresting the protesters?
No, I don't think that's what we're talking about. I think there are other more peaceful ways to do that. And, you know, we're certainly going to be looking at how we can take and address the needs, like I just said, the needs of those in the park and get them help. And, you know, then we'd have to be looking at certain measures to get the protest dealt with.
So you're talking about solving the problem so there's nothing to protest. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but realizing that there's solutions to this, but they're not going to happen overnight. So right now, kind of triage the situation. And, you know, it's our understanding that once the demands were heard and discussed by the city commission, that would and were in good faith, and I'm directed to meet with them and work on this in good faith, that they would be clearing the park, and that doesn't seem to be happening.
What's the next step?
Well, we've got a meeting this morning with them, and we're going to keep working on the demands and really focusing on short-term solutions to immediate basic needs. And at the same time, we've got folks around the table that really want to and have been working on the longer-term solution of affordable housing. you know, we've been working on affordable housing prior to this protest. We've got a partnership with LISC, the Local Initiative Support Corporation. We have a $13.5 million agreement over the next 3 years for housing, and a portion of which will go towards affordable housing. We have our Shared Prosperity Kalamazoo initiative, and that's more of a holistic approach, focusing on youth, families, and jobs. And obviously part of those services under Shared Prosperity would help to keep people in homes safe and address their overall needs. And, you know, we issue payment in lieu of taxes for affordable housing. We've done several of those over the last few years. So what this has done is shined a brighter light on it and given us more focus to address the issue of homelessness, which is unacceptable to have as a community.
Jim Ritzema is Kalamazoo's city manager. Thanks very much for taking time.
Thank you, Lester.
By the way, we reached out to the Kalamazoo Gospel Mission to request an interview with its leader, Pastor Michael Brown. We'll have a talk with him next week. Chemicals commonly known as PFAS are being discovered at more and more sites across Michigan. So here's the deal. If you live near one of these contaminated places, you likely have a lot of questions, and we want to hear them. Give us a call at 734-764-7840. Just tell us your name, where you live, how long you've been aware of the PFAS contamination near you, and then ask your question. We'll try to get answers for as many as we can. Here's that phone number again, 734-764-7840. Coming up,
especially as a new teacher, it's my second year, I find every day that there's something I wish I had, and the district just can't provide it for us all the time.
We'll talk with two teachers about what they spend out of their own pockets to do their jobs. That's in about 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There's a new Hollywood movie opening this weekend about Rick Wershe Jr., better known as White Boy Rick. The movie is called White Boy Rick.
Break it down. The dime rocks. Get yourself a crew and offload it. Before long, people know you're legit.
It's Ricky. He won.
Scott Bernstein was a consultant on the film. He's also a journalist with the Oakland Press and an author of books on organized crime in Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
I should say happy welcome again.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a reporter, I'm wondering, did you cover any of White Boy Rick? You're probably not old enough, right?
Well, I didn't cover what I call the first part of the story, which was in the 1980s, but I was the journalist that brought the story back to life in 2007, 2008, and was able to uncover what I call the second part of the story, which was the ability to confirm that he had been an undercover FBI informant as a 14-year-old and that White Boy Rick was, in fact, a creation of the U.S. government. That was a narrative that hadn't been played out during the 1980s coverage, and I take a lot of pride with being the journalist that really brought the story back to life, reinvigorated the conversation about White Boy Rick, and brought the injustice that really is his 30-year incarceration back to the masses over the last 10 years.
Now, I read some of the coverage at the time, you know, in historical articles, and I know at least one of the reporters who worked on it at the time. And then Rick Wershe Jr. was a drug kingpin who masterminded everything all as a teenager. Sounded like a great story. Do you think the understanding of the story has changed in recent years because of work like yours and the documentary that was recently released and now this movie?
Yeah, which I actually executive produced the documentary as well as served as a consultant on this film. Yeah, it's definitely changed. He wasn't a drug kingpin. He was an aspiring drug dealer, an aspiring what they would call weight man, someone who wanted to be a big-time wholesaler of cocaine, and he did it for a short period of time and, frankly, wasn't very good at it, got arrested and has been in prison since he was 18. But the idea that
that as a 14 or a 15 year old or a 16 year old that he was somehow, you know, lording over the Detroit drug scene just was a falsehood.
Why do you think the media latched onto that the way it did?
Because he was someone that became a high profile figure by the time he was 16, 17 years old. He was running in those circles, and he was being embraced by a lot of the top dogs, the Demetrius Holloways, the Maserati Rick Carters. His underworld career was co-signed by Johnny Curry, one of the biggest dope boys on the East Side, and that's who the FBI had sent him in to infiltrate, and he was able to rise through the ranks of the Curry boys. And just by kind of being in that orbit, you know, it was kind of like guilt by association.
Remind us how White Boy Rick ended up becoming an informant.
He was recruited out of eighth grade by a federal narcotics task force to join the Curry Brothers gang and provide intelligence to that task force on the goings-ons of the Curry Brothers gang. It was a operation that really was geared at taking down the mayor of Detroit, Coleman Young. Mm. Johnny Curry was married to Coleman Young's niece.
Right.
And the task force, which was made up of the FBI, DPD, and DEA, saw that by taking down Johnny Curry, they would be able to flip him and have Johnny give them the mayor. Now, that didn't happen, but that was the ultimate goal of that task force. So when they did that, it was like it was very drastic measures, taking a kid right out of eighth grade, a 14-year-old kid that had not much of a history at all on the streets. He had gotten into some petty crime as a juvenile and had worked with his father at gun shows selling weapons. But other than that, you know, he was a regular 14-year-old kid that, you know, played on his little league team and collected baseball cards, and the federal government took him and corrupted him. So I believe that that federal task force was, you know, operating under the belief that the ends justify the means, and that, you know, rationalized for them why they could use a 14-year-old kid, you know, to bust drug gangs.
So let's talk about the movie a little bit. Hollywood can be notoriously bad when telling a based on a real story movie. When you were approached, what was your reaction? What did you want them to know you would and would not do for them?
Well, I was approached at the, you know, very early stages of this development. Sony and Studio 8 hired me as a consultant in 2015. I was kind of on the ground floor getting to see the machinations of how a Hollywood film goes from just an idea and a script to something that's actually being, you know, shot on screen with big Hollywood superstars like Matthew McConaughey and Bruce Dern and tens of millions of dollars being put into it. And it was an exciting experience, something that I'd always wished to be able to be a part of, and I was a part of it. And, you know, yes, they fictionalized the story. They put some, you know, Hollywood glitz and glamour to the real story to make it more palatable to the big screen. So it's not, you know, it's not going to be 100% married to the real story of White Boy Rick Wershe Jr. and his father, Richard Sr., but, you know, it's pretty close.
Poetic license.
Yeah.
What did you want the producers and director to understand or not screw up about the White Boy Rick story?
Man, I wanted them to understand how this guy was a political prisoner, that, you know, that he was plucked out of junior high school and prostituted by the U.S. government, corrupted. And then when they sucked him dry for information and got everything that they couldn't get out of him, i.e. an indictment against Johnny Curry, they threw him to the side. And then eventually they threw him in a jail cell and tried to throw the key away.
Rick Wershe Jr., who was supposed to be in jail, life without probation.
He was sentenced to life without parole.
Yeah, and he got finally released last year after the law changed. So he's paroled in Michigan. Is he still in prison?
Yeah, he's actually – he was paroled from Michigan in 2017 and had to go over to serve a state sentence in Florida based on an arrest he took while behind bars in a federal witness protection unit back in 2005. So he's got a couple years to serve in Florida. He played a minor role in a stolen car ring from behind bars, and he's got a couple years left to do there. I think there's a very good chance he could be out and a free man by the summer of 2019.
Have you had contact with him about this movie? What's he think about this idea?
You know, he's been very excited about it. You know, being able to have your story told on the big screen, to be able to interact with big Hollywood moguls like the people that are making this film. I mean, the producers of this film have Oscars. To have Matthew McConaughey come in and sit with you in prison and play your father, you know, it's pretty heady for him. But I know that it's something that he's incredibly grateful for the fact that Hollywood's come in and wants to shine a light on this, you know, giant injustice that really was kept under wraps for a long time.
A lot of movies about Detroit aren't necessarily shot in Detroit, and a lot of this wasn't either. How did they portray the city from Detroit in the 1980s? They do a good job?
I thought that the director, Jan Demange, you know, did an excellent job at, you know, setting a tone and a visual narrative, you know, capturing the real grittiness of what was going on, the kind of the dark times in our city where we were being ravished by the crack epidemic. There was a lot of destruction, a lot of despair. And I think that when you watch the movie, that aura comes across in by some outstanding directing by Jan Demange.
The film is White Boy Rick. Matthew McConaughey plays the father. Newcomer Richie Merritt, 17 years old, plays Rick Worshey Jr., and the movie is in theaters now. My guest is Scott Bernstein. You also have a new book to be released on Kindle. What's it called?
It's called White Boy Rick and Crime in Detroit. It's a compilation of my writings on him, on his case, on what was going on in that era. Over the last 10 years, I've done quite a bit of chronicling of Detroit in the 1980s. So just kind of put it all together into one ebook and you can get that. And it's a, you know, it's a quick read. And I think a lot of the stuff jumps off the page because, you know, the material is just so great.
Right.
It would be hard
not to. Fascinating story, yeah. It will be released tomorrow. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Lester.
You might have felt like you had to spend a ridiculous amount of money for school supplies for your kids this year. But guess who else is buying school supplies for your kids? Their teachers. Often different teachers spend different amounts, and we know of a teacher in Ann Arbor who spends about $200 each year on glue sticks, folders, markers, colored pencils, cleaning supplies. We know of one Ypsilanti teacher who spent $700 this year on supplies, including a nice rug so her little students can sit on the floor during story time. Well, joining us now are a couple of other Michigan teachers. First, let me introduce Cassandra Joss, who is a third grade teacher in Sterling Heights. She's been a teacher for 16 years, and she joins us on the phone. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And here in the studio is Kara Weinstein, who's a fifth grade teacher in Ypsilanti. This is her second year of teaching.
Thanks for having me.
So do each of you spend money out of your pocket for your classroom?
I absolutely do, especially as a new teacher. It's my second year. I find every day that there's something I wish I had, and the district just can't provide it for us all the time.
How about you, Cassandra?
Absolutely. Spend money all of the time.
Is it okay if I ask how much you spend?
For me, this year, I'm about $250 in. It will increase more throughout the year, but it has gotten less because I am a 16-year teacher.
Oh, right. So you have a collection of stuff already, yeah.
Correct.
Kara, how much did you spend?
For me, it's hard to say. Probably between $300 and $400. Just you are trying to prepare stuff, and I just don't have the stuff to prepare stuff at sometimes. So sometimes it's going out and just buying a paper cutter because I'm working at home on the weekends. So for me, it's kind of still establishing like my base collection of stuff.
Well, Cassandra, you have your base collection. What kinds of things do you buy now?
Well, I have to replace bulletin board orders every year. There are bins, storage. We aren't provided any of that. That often cracks and breaks throughout the year and needs to be replaced. Indoor recess games and things for my third graders to do. We are initially usually supplied pencils and crayons and glue, and parents contribute to that, but halfway through the year that runs out. So there are multiple things.
Kara, what do fifth graders need?
So the same things. I work in Ypsilanti, and we actually have a couple of fabulous community partners. I just want to shout out to Ipsy Kids School Supplies. We have a person named Heather who gets a lot of that stuff for us, the crayons, the pencils, stuff like that. For me, luckily I have a lot of people who will give me their kind of hand-me-downs when they buy new stuff, but the same sort of things, bulletin boards, flexible seating, which is like different spots for the kids to sit. I also find myself buying stuff for the kids. Like I always keep granola bars on hand because you never know when kids are going to come and not need it. I teach fifth graders, so I keep feminine products in my classroom. Things like that I buy myself.
Why aren't the school districts, why don't they have the budget to supply these kinds of things if they're needed in the classroom?
there's been a drastic reduction in state funding, and so this is a place that they can cut. When I first began teaching, we had a huge supply closet. It had many, many materials in it that we could just have access to. Over the last couple of years, that's changed. We're not allowed in the supply closet. We have to fill out a request form. We're often told, we're sorry, what you put on your form is no longer available. So it's just a lot of state funding trickling down.
And for you, Kara?
It's the same in our district. We have a lot of budget problems just trying to hire teachers at times. So the supplies are kind of the last thought almost in our district. So it's basically the same thing.
Yeah, typically personnel costs are like 85% of a school's
right.
budget. I'm wondering if you've ever had to alter your lesson plans because the district couldn't provide the supplies and they were just too expensive for you to buy. Has that happened? Is that kind of thing? Is that what we're at risk of?
I would say so, 100%. Science projects I have not done before because of the materials that I would have to go out and buy on my own. And the reality is that I'm making less now than I was 5 years ago. So it's now getting to a point where some of those things need to go, because I'm personally taking home less money and have to pay my own bills and take care of my own children.
What do you mean you're making less money?
Over the last 5 years, we've had to pay way more into our insurance. We've taken furlough days. Our health care has gone up. Our retirement has gone up. So all of these things are taking money away from my salary, in addition to not having steps or freezes within my contract.
Gotcha. Kara, have you had to change the lesson plan?
Yeah. For us, it's technology. A lot of our lessons have technology components, and it's working with what we have. We don't have any smart boards or interactive boards where you can like write on the board. So sometimes you kind of have to modify the materials that come with your curriculum. I have a few programs I'm required to have the kids on for a certain amount of times. And last year I had 32 kids with 10 iPads. So you have to be creative to be able to get that instructional time that the district requires in. But science, the same thing. We actually were supposed to have a science teacher this year, but we don't because of budget cuts. So I'm not sure what that even looks like yet.
There's always a suggested school supply list for parents. But, you know, often there's a request, can you help out with this in the classroom? How often do parents actually help with general supplies for the classroom?
I would say I'm, you know, blessed to have great parents. So if I do send home a note mid-year that says, you know, we're out of Clorox wipes, we're out of Kleenex, I'm running really low on glue, there's always some parents in my classroom that will donate.
At my school, so I am in a lower socioeconomic status area, and so I have a hard time asking our parents for stuff, partly because I'm new, partly because I know it's a struggle for them. All of our kids automatically get free lunch and breakfast, so our parents definitely do what they can, but it's hard for our parents to make that happen. So they will send in. I was surprised how much was sent in the first day of school last year. But other than that, I don't get much from my parents.
And I would agree with that statement, too. I am also a Title I school, 70% free and reduced lunch. So they absolutely do what they can, but that's not always possible on their part.
The state constitution indicates a public school education is to be free, and the school is to supply everything. Parents and teachers shouldn't have to spend a dime. How realistic is that?
That is totally, it's not happening. It's completely unrealistic currently.
I would agree. And I think that could we provide an education for our kids without spending our own money? Yeah, we could do it. We could make it work. But the classrooms wouldn't be comfortable, we wouldn't be teaching to the best of our ability, and the kids wouldn't get the experience that they deserve. And I think as a teacher, I go out and spend my own money because my kids absolutely deserve that.
Was there a time, Cassandra, when teachers didn't have to buy as many supplies for the classroom?
I think it's gotten more, yes, but in my 16 years, that's always just been a part of the job, which I just find crazy because I think most jobs, when you're required to do something as part of your job, you're provided the resources that you need to do that job. And in education, it's just never been that way.
Well, what would the two of you like to see changed?
I would like to see, obviously, an increase in state funding. We are handed down a lot of mandates for the state. I'm in third grade. There's a large third grade reading bill that was passed. We have been given no resources from the state. So things that they're passing and requiring of us, they need to also back it up with the resources and the training.
I would have to say the same thing. It's harder for me to say as a newer teacher. I'm a lot more confident this year and have a lot more supplies. But almost even having classroom libraries for first-year teachers. I know beginning your career, that's a huge thing. We don't have classroom libraries in my district. All the books in my classroom are mine. So maybe having classroom libraries just for kids, getting those resources would be extremely helpful.
I also think some type of reimbursement or tax write-off. Teachers are allowed $250 a year for a tax write-off, which really is not much. So maybe something along those lines that could help ease that pain too.
That is Cassandra Josh. She's a third grade teacher in Sterling Heights. Kara Weinstein is a fifth grade teacher in Ypsilanti. Thanks to both of you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Still to come, we will hear gubernatorial candidates Bill Schuette and Gretchen Whitmer and where they stand on the Healthy Michigan Plan and Medicaid. Michigan Radio is expanding its environmental coverage. We'll tell you about that after the break, so stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan Radio is expanding its reporting on the environment. After hearing what listeners told us they wanted, we decided to do more enterprise and investigative stories to add more depth to our understanding of Michigan's environment. Rebecca Williams joins us now. You know her from her many, many years of environmental reporting here on Michigan Radio. Hi, Reb.
Hey, Lester.
So we did the math, right? And I think that together, combined, we've been reporting on the environment something close to 40 years, the two of us, thousands and thousands of stories. But you've been doing this twice-a-week thing for about 8 years, and doing a twice-a-week report doesn't always give you the time and the latitude to go in-depth.
Right, to talk to sources, to put together investigative series, to file Freedom of Information Act requests.
So what kind of stories do you think need that treatment?
Issues of water withdrawals, climate change, Enbridge's Line 5 is a big one, the continuing ramifications of the Flint water crisis.
Right. And now you and I and our team are working on this series on PFAS water contamination in the state, which is getting a lot of headlines, and that's taking a lot of time and effort.
That's right. You, me, reporters Kayla Fond and Bryce Huffman, and our editor Sarah Hewlett, all of us are working on that PFAS series right now.
Yeah, we're trying to wrap up that series before too long because it's scheduled to air in the first week of October.
Right. So this is important to note. In the future, people are not going to hear the 2 4-minute segments on the air every week. Instead, we're going to dig deeper into the environmental issues that are making news. You'll hear those stories in newscasts, in longer stories on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, digital first reporting, and interviews here on Stateside. And I'm really excited, Lester, because you are going to be joining in on the reporting.
Yeah, I'm pretty thrilled about it, too. As some of you know, I covered the environment for Michigan Radio from 1998 to 2010 before I started working on some other important issues. But all of my career, dating back to 1985, I've really been interested in environmental issues that affect the food we eat, the water we drink, the air that we breathe. So I'm excited about being back.
There's so many stories to tell that having this team to be able to work together, more reporters now working on environmental issues, it's more important than ever.
And right, we've got the website now in a way that we didn't have in the early days of covering the environment. So we can have graphs, we can have stories on web that go beyond what the radio does to give people some of that in-depth flavor of environmental coverage.
That's right, MichiganRadio.org. Again, this first big series from Michigan Radio is on PFAS contamination in the state. You'll be able to hear that reporting the first week of October.
Rebecca Williams, thank you so much for all the years you worked on Michigan Radio's Great Lakes Radio Consortium and the Environment Report, and for a long time on your own. I believe you've worked on environmental issues longer than anyone in the station's 70-year history. So congratulations, and I'm looking forward to working with you more.
Thank you, Lester. I can't wait to have you back on the team.
This election year, we're doing some quick interviews on one topic with the candidates running for governor. The topic today is Medicaid and the Healthy Michigan Plan. And our first candidate is Democrat Gretchen Whitmer. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
The Trump administration is actively diminishing the Affordable Care Act, and it wants to end Obamacare altogether. What's your position on whether it should end?
It should definitely not end. You know, as a state senator, I worked with the Republican Governor Rick Snyder. We worked bipartisanly to make sure that we, Michigan, move forward on Medicaid expansion. It's called Healthy Michigan, and we've got 680,000 people health care coverage in this state. It's been a game changer for so many families, a life-saving thing. It's benefited our economy, and it's just been a really good thing for Michigan, and it's one of the things that I'm most proud of from the work that I did in the legislature.
If you're elected governor, what power would you have to keep the Affordable Care Act from disappearing?
Well, we've seen, you know, Congress and President Trump attack it three times in the last year and a half. And every time that happens, everyone who's got a pre-existing condition, every family that's seen a doctor for the first time because of this health care is in jeopardy and fearful and afraid. I, as governor, can make sure that we in Michigan protect the work that we did, that we work to expand upon it, and that we fight attacks on Medicaid expansion. This has been a good thing for us in Michigan, and that the biggest threat to health care for people in Michigan right now is Bill Schuette, my opponent who's running for governor.
Your campaign has accused Republican candidate Bill Schuette of not supporting guaranteed coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. He has said on the record that he does support the pre-existing condition coverage mandate, and his campaign accuses yours of being misleading. What's your response?
Oh, give me a break. You know, Bill Schuette has filed lawsuit after lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. He would not join a lawsuit that 17 other attorneys general did to protect people who have pre-existing conditions. So, you know, he can try to hide from his record, but the fact of the matter is, for years, he's been using taxpayer dollars to try to take away health care from people here in Michigan. And I don't think anyone's buying it. In the Republican primary for governor, he even attacked Brian Kelly on Healthy Michigan, and he's currently sending out letters asking people to support him and donate to his campaign because he wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So it's baloney when they try to spew that now, and I don't think anyone's buying it.
The Healthy Michigan plan, as we've been talking about, is an expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Michigan, the state, has asked the federal government for a waiver to implement a work requirement for able-bodied adults. What do you think of that?
I oppose the work requirement. I think it is undoing what is the greatest part of work that happened under the Snyder administration. And I certainly didn't agree with Governor Snyder on everything, but I do believe that it took courage to embrace Medicaid expansion, and we worked very well together across the partisan line in order to get it done. 680,000 people got health care. This so-called work requirement is not for one second about getting people back to work. If it was, it would have been focused on leveling barriers to employment, like opening up training for skills or giving people childcare options or transportation options. So this wasn't really about getting people to work. It was about taking health care away from people, and it's going to devastate a lot of families in Michigan.
You've suggested this kind of program, like Healthy Michigan, should be further expanded to include more people. How would that work?
Well, I think that there are some things that we can do. Number one, we've got to have a governor who's going to protect the work that we have done, and it's a very stark choice in this election. We can embrace Medicaid expansion or elect someone who wants to repeal it. We can use state funds to open up more opportunities for people to buy into the program, and I think that that kind of a small investment as a state would yield huge returns for us in terms of the health of our population, the readiness of workers to get into employment, and simply taking care of people that need help the most. And so I think there are a lot of things that we can do, but first and foremost, we've got to protect the work that I did with Rick Snyder on Healthy Michigan.
Do you support the idea of a single-payer plan?
I support the concept of universal coverage, of getting everyone covered. I, you know, didn't embrace a single payer in the primary because I just don't think that it's doable as a standalone state. Now, that being said, I am committed as governor to getting everyone in our state covered, but not waiting on Washington to try to fix the problem. We've got to have some state solutions here, and we're really working with a lot of experts to make sure that we've got the smartest plan out there.
How would you pay for something like that?
Well, the question is, you know, every decision we make as a state has benefits to it. And what yields the most, it's when we educate our people, it's when we make sure everyone's got clean drinking water, safe roads, affordable car insurance, and access to health care. And so this is one of those fundamental investments that is going to improve life for everyone here in Michigan, whether you're a head of a household or you're the head of a business.
Bill Schuette has said he believes the federal government will sooner or later withdraw support for the Medicaid expansion Healthy Michigan plan. He says Michigan taxpayers would ultimately be left holding the bag, paying the bill. How concerned are you about that?
Listen, you know, we can't prognosticate about what Congress is going to look like, but I think right now in this climate, it's a very real possibility that the political environment is going to change for the better, and that means that we'll have more people in Congress who understand how important these health care choices and this has been for people across our country. And I think, you know, his assumptions are all wrong. And regardless, my values are about getting people access to affordable, quality health care and saving people's lives, getting them healthy and getting them back into the workforce.
You've been on the campaign trail for a long time now. Where does health care and health care coverage rank in voters' concerns?
I think it's at the very top. There's no question. I have met people in our state who have seen a doctor for the first time because of Medicaid expansion. We have averted, you know, so many horrifying possibilities of people who don't get diagnosed with disease and get the kind of treatment that they need. An undiagnosed glaucoma that could have, you know, blinded someone. They've now gotten the treatment that they need. And so, I mean, it's these stories that I hear every single day that tell me the work that I did crossing the aisle and working with Rick Snyder on this has really improved lives for people. And I'm proud of that.
Gretchen Whitmer is the Democratic nominee for governor. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
Joining us now is the Republican candidate for governor, Bill Schuette. Hi there.
Hey, Lester. Great being with you. Good afternoon.
So we're talking about health care coverage today. You joined a lawsuit back in 2011 to block the Affordable Care Act. Some people call it Obamacare. Do you still believe it should end?
You know, Healthy Michigan is the law of the land of our state, and it's not going anywhere. And what really we need to do is make sure we have affordable and accessible health care for people across the state. And I want to help it be better and reform so that we have a work requirement for able-bodied people. And what's the significance of that? It's about making sure that people have a job. There are, if we can train people and give them an opportunity to have a paycheck and, you know, be in employment, I think that's a wonderful thing for folks when there's so many jobs out there that you know, every employer and job provider I talk with, they're trying to fill the job with talent. So we ought to provide those who have are able-bodied with an opportunity for a job. I think the Medicaid work requirement is an important ingredient simply because to help people. Now, I want to be real clear. My opponent, Senator Whitmer and Garland Gilchrist, it's a Democrat scare tactic about this whole issue of health care and Medicaid expansion. For years now, I have said we need to cover pre-existing conditions and make sure that children are covered till they're 26 years of age and have portability of health care across state lines. And so the scare tactic that Senator Whitmer and Garland Gilchrist are using, frankly, it's a Democratic effort they're going on across America. It's a scare tactic. It's not true. It's false and it's a lie. And listen.
Hey, let me get a question in here. Okay.
Sure.
So I want to go back to something you just said. You said the Michigan Medicaid expansion. It's the law. It's not going anywhere. But I want to know if the legislature sent you a bill ending the Healthy Michigan plan as governor, would you sign it?
Now, listen, I'm going to have affordable, accessible health care, and the legislature's not going to do that. And the point here is that, you know, people have a chronic problem who can't work and qualify for Healthy Michigan. We're going to make sure they get the health care they deserve. And, again, this is just a ploy because the extreme approach that, say, Garland Gilchrist has taken in anti-Israeli rants and pro-Hamas tweets and Gretchen Whitmer's desire to eliminate ICE and dismantle the Department of Homeland Security is reckless and unwise and extreme. They're trying to change the subject to this these false attacks on health care. It's wrong, and it does a disservice to people.
You are on the record as supporting letting children stay on their parents' health insurance plan until age 26 and guaranteeing coverage for pre-existing conditions. Those are both part of the Affordable Care Act. How does that work if Congress and the president end Obamacare?
Well, you know, what Congress has been doing is eliminating the taxes and the severe problems associated with the Affordable Care Act. And remember, what we saw with the Affordable Care Act on a nationwide basis were premiums went up. You weren't able to change you weren't able to choose your own doctor. And what my opponents want to do is have a government-run health care, and there'll be more taxes. Their version of health care is having taxes and more taxes and having a government-run health care, which means you won't be able to choose your doctor. And we should have market-based solutions, not a government-based solution. And that's really the decision will be made in Michigan. Do you want a government-run healthcare system, or do you want to have people making choices and opportunities and more jobs? And that's the private sector, market-oriented solution that is better for Michigan and America's future.
Well, how would that work, considering we had a market-based system and a lot of people couldn't get insurance or couldn't afford insurance or had a pre-existing condition? How do you take care of those things in your plan?
Well, see, what happened is that in Congress, there was an inability to strip out some of the bad problems of the Affordable Care Act that has finally got done with some of the taxes. And we need to keep pre-existing conditions. We need to keep children on the insurance until they're 26. You can do both of these things in America today, but trying to have a government-run health care program is a solution that will be more taxes, and frankly, paychecks will go down. And the extreme position of the Whitmer-Gilchrist team really is all about more taxes, whether it's on roads, more taxes, whether it's on health care, more taxes, whether it's on small business development. You know what? That would just send Michigan's employment back to the days of former Governor Jennifer Granholm and those failed policies. And that's the choice that people have in this election. And we don't need more taxes and government-run health care. We need more choices and options in private sector initiatives.
Governor Snyder has asked the federal government for approval to allow Michigan to implement a work requirement for able-bodied adults in order to get Healthy Michigan coverage. What do you think of that?
You know, the governor and I agree on this, important that we make sure that we have this Medicaid work requirement, and the waiver I'm hopeful will be issued. And I think it's a positive thing to make sure that those who are able-bodied, we can give them an opportunity for work and be on a payroll, and making sure we have the resources to give assistance to those who need help in health care.
When you're out talking to voters, how important is the issue of health care coverage to them? What do they tell you?
You know, it's very important to folks, no matter what your walk of life might be. It's all about if you have a chronic illness or how do you deal with the complexities of health care today, and people get fearful of the government telling them what to do. And so this issue of health care and choice and the fear of a government-run health care system, and which gets, you know, people feel sometimes nervous and fearful about the government, but they want to have affordable and accessible health care. And I hear that, and I sense it, and I talk about it. And so we're going to do that. We're going to make sure that we have Healthy Michigan's not going anywhere. Let's reform it with a Medicaid work requirement. Governor Snyder and I agree with that.
You know, there are 650,000 people on the Affordable Care Act, the Michigan Healthy Michigan plan, I mean, and 300,000 Michiganders who are enrolled in the Affordable Care Act. Do you think they all want to get off that and on something else?
I think what we need to do is make sure we have options and opportunity for people. And that's why if you're able-bodied, adult, let's have this reform and how we can enhance the Healthy Michigan program with a Medicaid work requirement, and then making sure that those resources that we can provide for those who have a chronic problem qualify.
Attorney General, we're running out of time. I really appreciate your time. That's Bill Schuette. He's the Republican candidate for governor. Thanks for talking with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Today's Stateside, directed by Lindsay Scullin, engineered by Mike Blank. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Hey, have a great weekend.